I'm not Rachel Maddow.
And I'm not Anderson Cooper.
You do look a little like him. And I've never seen you in the same place at the same time. Are you sure you're not Anderson?
I'm pretty sure I'm not Anderson Cooper. I almost hit on him at the Abbey in Los Angeles, but he walked out before I had a chance to do so. So I'm pretty sure I'm not Anderson.
Ouch. Wow. Well, they both are great journalists, meaning Rachel and Anderson Cooper, and they cover serious topics in a meaningful way.
And they're also both gay.
But they don't just cover gay news?
In fact, most of the topics they cover are not gay news stories.
Gay journalists covering straight news? Mind blown.
Hey, maybe they're just good journalists doing their jobs and covering meaty topics.
Totes possible. Speaking of meaty topics, this episode will cover a few of our own.
But before we do, let's take a merry detour through some lighter stuff.
Welcome to the third episode of A Broad Range of Intelligent People.
We're back with Shep, who we're pretty sure is straight.
So am I. Hi again, guys.
Okay, so let's get down to business. Who wants to talk about the Emmys?
Did you say the Emmys?
I definitely said the Emmys.
Oh my goodness. Who was nominated?
All sorts of people. And, you know, I've been spending so much time on my couch over the past year that I actually have seen a lot of these things.
Okay. Well, tell us some of the shows that were nominated.
Well, The Mandalorian and The Crown are tied for 24 nominations apiece. And then we also have WandaVision, Queen's Gambit, but there's been a lot of really good stuff. And I think that there is possibly an increase in diverse representation in the nominations this year.
Well, I think if there's a baby Yoda involved, then I certainly think that that brings in diversity. And I think, Shep, this is right up your alley. Tell us all about The Mandalorian and everything else.
You're walking down my street. Well, the first thing about this is that none of the categories, none of the nominees that you mentioned are on one of the four major networks. We're all talking about streaming services and or cable, which I also find to be fascinating. It seems in the last two decades, they've kind of taken off and taken over. But two of them that you mentioned are on Disney Plus, one on Netflix, and you mentioned, let me see, Queen's Gambit, Netflix, WandaVision and Mandalorian, Disney Plus, and you mentioned The Crown, also Netflix. So there they go. Those are two studios as well as streaming services that seem to be doing very well for themselves and being very successful providing original content. The Mandalorian comes out of and is the first successful Star Wars TV series. There will be about five that follow it, but this will be probably the home base. And then WandaVision was the first of, so far, four Marvel TV series, all based on the existing Marvel Cinematic Universe, with plenty more to come. And in a first, one of the characters from one of the television series ended up in, at the end of, Black Widow, which is the first movie in Phase 4 of the Marvel series. So they're very much doing a back and forth with TV and film, letting fans know you can't miss either. That's good casting or what have you. Of the three or four upcoming Star Wars series, many of the characters have appeared in Mandalorian. Also, just letting you know, foreshadowing, watch this to get what's going to happen in that, which for sci-fi fans is huge in terms of continuity. My understanding is the ratings were so good that there is a sequel to not The Crown and not Queen's Gambit. I'm thinking of Bridgerton. There will be a follow-up to Bridgerton, which is also a runaway success and also had a huge, diverse cast. So Hollywood has seemed to listen to actors and fans and who they cast and how they cast and what they present on screen in terms of who loves who. That's all I got to say.
Well, I think you have a lot more to say than that, Shep, because I don't have a whole lot to say it on this topic because according to you, what is all that I watched?
Home and Garden TV and maybe a couple of rock and roll documentaries.
Yeah, some rock and roll documentaries and stuff, but come on. No. White people doing what?
The show, everything that comes on HGTV, every television series, I label them so I don't have to remember what they are. I call all those shows White People Buy Houses. Because that's what's happening on all the shows. So, you know, not to say I don't enjoy it, but that's what's happening. So why are we pretending anything else is going on?
That's a thing. It's totally a thing. I have to wonder, as a big sci-fi freak, and I mean, like, I live for sci-fi. Years ago, sci-fi, comic book, fantasy had been completely blocked out of all the awards and was not taken seriously. Is sci-fi finally having its day?
So nerds didn't have dates, so they were able to save a lot of money. And I remember I was hanging out with a friend this week, and I remember we took his son to the first Transformers movie. He didn't know anything about or care about Transformers, but we were losing our mind. And so geeks now have disposable income, and they're going to dispose it on what it is they want to see. Rachel, if I go to a Star Wars movie with you, I know you're a big Star Wars fan. If I go to a Star Wars movie with Anderson, he's in it, you know, because we're around the same age, and he remembers things that I remember. But he doesn't have the, oh, that means that, and that means that, and that means that, and that means that, that I have. If we have gone to see several Spider-Man films, and he's enjoyed them as films, I am looking at them with my encyclopedia hand saying, okay, that was from issue 714, that was from issue 285, that was from the crossover. What is presented on screen for a comic book fan has to be, quote, comic book accurate. We got the money, we're going to spend it, and they go where, look, Anthony Hopkins has been in comic book movies, Tilda Swinton, Jeremy Irons, some of the bigger names in Hollywood flock to this stuff because they pay well. Liam Neeson, who's reinvented himself as an action star, started in the Batman franchise. Michael Keaton probably wouldn't have a career if it would not been for being cast in Batman and when the film came out in 1989. I mean, he was a good comedian, but where's Joe Piscopo right now, hosting a radio show? Anyway, I mean, they have to bend to what it is that people want to pay for. And since there are no original ideas in Hollywood, people are mining Stephen King. They've gone through pretty much all that Philip K. Dick has to say. They bought Star Wars from George Lucas so they can stop taking his perspective and just squeeze every bit of juice out of that lemon. And Star Trek is very successful on TV again. Once again, not on a network, but on a streaming service. And even though the shows may not be as good as the ones that we grew up with, they're killing it and guaranteeing that there will be. There's a Star Trek cartoon on right now. That's murdering ratings such as it is. So these companies are smart enough to make things that have a broad appeal to families, because most of the unanointed are mistaken that these are family shows, and they aren't. They're absolutely pointed at 26 to 58-year-old men, you know, eating popcorn, sitting in their skivvies, watching this stuff, going through each of the issues of the comic books as they're watching it on TV, saying, yep, 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 yep. And there's some incredibly dope, the Black Widow movie that's in theaters right now, her character was sterilized because they thought it would make her a better spy if she couldn't produce offspring so she wouldn't have anybody else to worry about in her life, so she'd be willing to die. That's not material that mom and dad and Becky and Susie or Becky and Jimmy should indulge or take in when they go to see a flick. But there it is, and it's right now averaging about $1 billion a movie. So, you know.
I have to say, I was looking down the list of nominees. Bowen Yang, who is on Saturday Night Live, is a gay Asian.
He's an actor. He's also a great writer and is probably.
Well, I mean, he's most known, I think, for the Iceberg episode, which was freaking amazing. I'm really glad to see Bowen Yang there, and I think that he does add to the overall variety and warmth and diversity of the show. And I was surprised to see that he was nominated.
Back up a second, Rachel. You're talking about the X-Wing pilot on the episode where the Mandalorian crashed into a iceberg kind of a thing with the frog mom? I'm
talking about Saturday Night Live.
Oh, okay, yes, because I thought you were talking about a character who was on Mandalorian. And no, my point about that character was he has a show that's on Netflix called Kim's Convenience. I highly recommend it. It's another Canadian show in the light of Schitt's Creek. But the gentleman you're speaking of recently had a offshoot project that I cannot remember where, but I think he wrote and may have directed some of it. And it is... I don't remember the name of it, but it's doing very well. And so I think that Mr. Yang is being appreciated for his overall work and the overall contribution. And in light of a year where we're talking about anti-Asian violence and underrepresentation, I mean, again, they were talking about underrepresentation of Asians in Hollywood overall. And so Crazy Rich Asians starring Henry Golding, He now stars in Snake Eyes, the first offshoot of the G.I. Joe franchise. He's being looked at for James Bond. He's appeared in two big productions that don't involve Asian-only casts. One is, I think it's called A Favor. It is Anna Kendrick and one of the blonde daughters, Blythe Danner's daughter, and whose name escapes me right now. But he was the love interest in that movie, and he played the villain in The Gentleman, which was a Guy Ritchie movie starring McConaughey, which was in theaters before the pandemic and probably made $12.50 because it was the only thing that people would go see. Not so great, but he was a villain in that. So
MJ Rodriguez from Pose, which is definitely one of my favorite. I've seen every episode and cried through most of it. Pose is getting a lot of coverage. MJ Rodriguez is giving a lot of coverage. Can we contrast that with The Mandalorian, which had an anti-trans activist as one of its primary supporting characters? So is there some weird balance going on here between MJ Rodriguez and Mandalorian? I mean, MJ Rodriguez as Blanca, I want her to be my mother because she would just, she was amazing. And she totally took me there. And, you know, I was a teenager during the time that most of this takes place. And I, you know, I lived through those times, and I know what it's like to be a street kid, a gay street kid. I wasn't living in New York at the time, but I, you know, I was homeless during this period of time, and I loved this show. And I just, you know, I saw Blanca being nominated, and I saw the amount of coverage or the amount of nominations that Mandalorian's gotten, and it just seemed like an interesting juxtaposition. I'm a fan of both shows, but knowing how much anti-trans coverage The Mandalorian has gotten, it seemed like an interesting juxtaposition.
I would say that the what's being brought into the light, or where the, I would say that the perspective of the anti-trans person is the one that would be more highlighted as unusual in Hollywood. Not that the anti-trans perspective is unusual in Hollywood, or maybe it is, but the fact that a libertarian would be getting such coverage in Hollywood the way that Hollywood is now. Rodriguez's perspective is the perspective that I would probably consider to be mainstream now, not so much highlighting something that is unusual, unheard of, or unheralded. Hollywood right now is paying a lot of attention to the LGBT community, paying a lot of attention to the a community that had been lambasted or ignored before, and the fact that a libertarian has a platform, and by the way, Disney and Marvel have said, not here, honey. But the fact that they're getting support from somebody, and her politics aren't coming out through her work. I think that would be the only difference, is that she is allowed to play a character that doesn't represent her perspective. Basically, what she is in The Mandalorian, she shoots stuff. And she may even be seen as a feminist character. I would like to see Rodriguez and others be able to play anything that is presented on screen and not just be typed. And the story that she's telling is fantastic. And you said it had an overwhelming emotional impact on you. And that's what it should do and should be. It's art and it should touch people. I think the day that we'll have parentheses equality, unquote, is when she plays the bank president or the bounty hunter, or because people can be and do anything. That's what we're really trying to tell people. And your orientation doesn't inhibit, sometimes it enhances what it is you do see and want, but it doesn't make you less than this, that, or the other.
I completely agree, Shep. I think that, you know, I want to see many amazing things, many amazing new roles coming from Ms. Rodriguez in the future. So let's, I think we're going kind of heavy. So this might be a really good time to jump into the second part of the Richard Goldstein interview. So let's play the tape.
We're back with author, critic, professor, and progressive icon Richard Goldstein. Richard is an authority on rock music, pop culture, and politics, among many other topics. Today we're talking about the current state of American democracy. Richard, how do you think the American experiment is doing?
It's a perilous time right now. The polarization in the country, I'm one of those people who agree that the polarization is very dangerous. think that the class system is so locked in at this point that it produces an overwhelming amount of bitterness on all sides. And the struggle for racial equity and gender equity, which must be made, must be fought, also produces a terrible backlash, which people don't pay enough attention to. And finally, the hegemony of the wealthy, including the professional class, not just the billionaires. Now, everybody thinks the evil people are people who make more than them, but actually it's a larger group. That kind of hegemony, that kind of dominance doesn't play very well in people who are subaltern, who are below them on the social structure. And this stuff is extremely dangerous and could easily lead to a social breakdown and even worse, to a real decline of the country.
Will Trump ever be prosecuted?
He might be prosecuted. I'm not sure. I don't think he'll be convicted. You know, if he is, he'll be the most martyred jailbird in our history. So I don't know the answer. There's no way to tell. I'm much more worried about him coming back, convicted or not.
Do you think he's above the law?
No. I think in 10 years he might be. In other words, the law might change. There is no ultimate guarantee against tyranny.
Do you think we'll have another insurrection?
Yes, it could be. It could be. Again, I think that the prosecution of people who invaded the Capitol is going very well, and that 400 arrests have been made. So the message being sent to the insurrectionists is, we'll come after you if you try this again. But goaded on by a future administration, it could happen again. And it could happen on a local level in many places. So yes, there's a real danger here. Something that really needs to be dealt with is trying to wean away from the right the 10 or 15% who are subject to a more sort of reasonable and liberal ideas and may cross over enough to create a permanent majority. So I think that's worth trying.
Do you think the segment of the population that is sympathetic to the insurrectionists is gaining or losing strength right now?
I think they're losing strength right now, but in the next election, if the Democrats lose their majority in the Senate, not to mention the House, and so there's stasis and nothing can be accomplished. And then in the next presidential election, if there is an inflation or a recession, and those heroic suburban women who flocked to the Democrats in the blue wave and elected Biden don't have Trump to run against, and they cross over again and become Republicans, you could have a Republican majority in 4 years. And I think that would increase the danger. This is why I say that even at the risk of seeming utopian, it's important to try to win over people on the other side.
I've been seeing lately how a number of reliable election officials are facing death threats and are opting out of their positions, opening the door for individuals who may be less open to traditional democracy. At the same time, states like Florida are passing anti-voting rights legislation that has not been seen since before the civil rights era in the 60s. What are the chances we'll see free and fair elections in 2022 and 2024?
I think the chances depend on the composition of Congress and who is in the White House. If the Democrats can retain their majority in the Senate or increase it and can do the same in the House, I think that there can be federal laws passed that set certain standards for elections. There are limits to what the federal government can do because essentially states run elections. But in issues of fairness, there can be a federal a part of this. So everything depends on us retaining and expanding our majority. If we can't do that, we're going to lose out and we're going to have a retreat on voting rights, probably ratified by the Supreme Court. So I think it's very dangerous now. And then, once again, that's why I say it's worth the effort to try to win people over to our side.
Joe Manchin has expressed that he is against some of the voting rights legislation that is before the Senate right now. If there is no chance of passing federal voting rights protections, is there any chance at all for Democrats in 2022 and 2024?
Well, you know, yes, there is. First of all, they can't prevent people from registering and voting. They can make it difficult, but it can be overcome. Secondly, Manchin is representing the state of West Virginia as a Democrat. People in West Virginia don't think like people from the Bronx. That you have to bear that in mind. You actually don't have a lockstep on how people think. It's in a democracy, you have to take into account how other people think. Manchin is willing to go a certain distance toward reforming the election system. And so that may be all that we can accomplish at the moment. But in 2022, with an increased majority in the Senate, we may not need Manchin. So that's what we should be focusing on, how to increase our majority.
Are you sure that Manchin is actually representing the opinions of the voters in West Virginia? I've heard statistics that as many as 70% of West Virginians might be in favor of voting rights protections, and that perhaps he is out of step with his constituents.
Well, it's possible. I haven't seen those figures, but it's possible that he's to the right of many people in West Virginia. West Virginia is a Piedmont state. It didn't have slavery. It's got a unique history in the South. That's one of the places we can organize in. John F. Kennedy won the Democratic primary there, and I believe he even won the state. So it is possible. That's one of the states that can go purple. So if Joe Manchin is not representative of the state, he won't be there.
Is it possible he is paying more attention to donors than voters?
More donors rather than stoners? Yes. Yes, I think, that would make him unique among politicians, I think. So what can I say? Donors in West Virginia, that would be the coal industry, probably. And yes, he is pro-coal. So this is a very difficult question. How do we manage to shift away from coal without impoverishing the region? They both have to be taken into account. We have to accomplish a transition to green energy without causing people to be deracinated and deprived of income.
Last episode, we talked about media. What role do you think Fox has played in where we are today?
What Fox has done, I think, is to galvanize a voting bloc that has always existed but has been inchoate, had no real media voice before Fox. And now they do. So what Fox has done is what media throughout history have always done for their consumers, which is bring people together around a group identity. This is what the Village Voice did in the 60s. We brought a whole community of people who, you know, were scattered, basically, together. And this is also what the underground press did in the 60s. We brought a group of young people, millions of young people, who were just out there doing their thing together around a common agenda. So what Fox is doing is what the media have always done, which is, for profit, building a constituency and making it coherent and cohesive.
Right after the election, Fox experienced a significant drop-off in viewership, but the endurance of Trumpism is proving to be undeniable. They also got hit with a couple billion with a B dollar lawsuit for slander from Dominion, the maker of the vote counting machines. What do you think Fox's future looks like?
It's hard to say what Fox's future will be like. It could go in a more moderate direction, or it could move further to the right. Its competition right now is on the right from these other, even more extreme news networks that are kind of sexier than Fox. So, you know, if you're going to watch for vitality, you might move away from Fox. It's a little genteel these days compared to Newsmax. So if you want the real Republican red tie, you have to go to Newsmax. So I think that Fox might actually move further to the right in order to cut off its competition. But again, you know, this is what media do. They move. If you read the Times, New York Times 5 years ago, it's not the New York Times of today. They have moved in order to capture a certain readership. Fox has moved too. So it could go in that direction. The libel lawsuits, those are legitimate lawsuits from companies that feel that they were defamed, and it will be decided in court. And maybe they were defamed and Fox should pay out.
Let's talk a little bit more about these newcomers, Newsmax and AON. Who's funding them and why?
I don't know. There might be Russian money behind one or two of them. It might just be the usual Sheldon Adelson oligarchy, gamblers, people who run casinos in Macau, realtors. It could be the usual army of plutocrats, or it could be foreign powers. So there's no way to tell. They don't reveal their funders.
Is that legal if they're foreign investors?
No, I don't know if it's legal, but it's certainly. I mean, we have Russia Today Network. We have all kinds of things that the Russians do that they do through middlemen. They buy real estate. They buy all kinds of things. Lots of foreign countries buy in the United States, and we don't necessarily know about it. So why would media be exempt from that? Maybe it should be. I'd like to see how far a law about that gets.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't Rupert Murdoch have to become a U.S. citizen in order to gain control of Fox News?
Yeah, but it's like my dog becoming a citizen. You know, it didn't mean anything. Murdoch sits astride the globe. It doesn't matter where his passport originates in. So I just think it was a gesture. The fact is that, you know, he's a global businessman. We'll see what his heirs are like. His heirs might tend toward a more liberal direction.
I've heard one of his sons is more liberal.
Right, the infamous Lachlan, which I think sounds Scottish to me.
Is Trumpism about Trump, or is it something larger?
It is obviously something larger, because if it was only about Trump, he'd still be on The Apprentice. So, yes, there's something larger going on. There is a fundamental division in the country between people who are well-educated and people who are less well-educated, between people who are earning above a certain amount of money and people who are earning less. And those things line up with progressivism and conservatism in the world today. There's also a distinction between the interests of minority communities, black and brown people, women, and the interests of people who, at least in a social sense, had more prestige than they do today. Here I'm thinking of white males. Only about 25%, maybe less, of white males vote Democratic. That's a third of the population. So, you know, those distinctions are real, and they're enduring, and they're getting worse and worse. Now, how you actually resolve the necessary struggle for equality with the alienation of people who feel as if they're losing their country, this is a very difficult maneuver, but we have to try to do that. We have to try to achieve the equity and decrease the level of alienation at the same time. It's a lot harder than scratching your stomach and chewing gum.
Who are the most likely politicians to replace Trump if he is no longer a viable candidate?
I don't really know. Matt Gaetz. No, I don't think so. I don't really know. I would look. I personally am looking towards somebody like Cotton, Senator Cotton, who's a lot more dignified than Trump, but has the and a lot more buff, I might add, but is probably more conservative in a rib-rock way than Trump, and quite authoritarian. So the danger is a nice authoritarian, a respectable authoritarian. Pence is another example.
What about Hawley?
Who? Hawley? Yeah, it's possible. You know, Hawley started out as a somewhat liberal Republican and then maneuvered himself the way that Stefanik did into a pro-Trump position. So it may be that the successor to Trump has little in common with Trump, but is able to push those buttons.
What would it take to restore American democracy?
We are a democracy. We don't have to restore our democracy. We do have to bolster it, but it shouldn't be said that America is not a democracy. The whole reason why we have this struggle right now is because most people acknowledge and recognize that there is a potential in this country to evolve through democratic means into a unique society in world history. And what I mean by that is a society where the races, ethnicities, genders, sexualities, are on a relatively equal basis. There isn't one group that is permanently in charge. in every other country in the world, including the most diverse countries, like England, for example, one group is hegemonic. One group is in charge, and the other groups are arrayed against it. In America, what we're moving toward, to me, is a society where there's endless conflict and friction between groups that are constantly in collision, but nobody is in charge. And the way to gain power is through alliances of different groups. That's the society that I think there's a real potential for America becoming. And to me, it's a very, very strong society.
Can progressives, liberals, gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender people, racial minorities, survive if American democracy fails?
Survive, yes. Be happy, no. Our interests as members of various communities, and I'm Jewish and I include myself, depend entirely on the success of American democracy, of democracy in general. Speaking from Jewish experience, Jews do best in a society where there is a democratic process and nobody is actually making the rules permanently. Everybody has to make the rules anew every couple of years in an election. That's the environment that I think most minorities do best in.
If American democracy fails, what will GLBT people in particular need to do in order to survive?
Well, you know, you're assuming it's going to fail from the right and not from the left. In other words, the left isn't going to take over. If the left took over, the LGBT people would be fine, but other people would suffer. So let's assume that, in fact, we're talking about a right-wing takeover of the country. And yes, there could be, infinite hardship, all the way toward murder. So I've argued this against Andrew Sullivan, who tells me that I'm a hysteric. But again, from a Jewish perspective, murder is possible. So, yes, there's a tremendous danger in the destruction of American democracy. But it's not just for LGBT people. I have left out some of the letters and the plus sign. Please forgive me. It's for black and brown people, and it's for women, too. Remember that when the Nazis took over, they had taken over from an era in Germany where people spoke of the new woman. And they replaced it with, I think it was kitchen, culture, and church as the motto for women. So that's, there is a masculinist connection to right-wing governance. And yes, it will take a toll on everyone else.
Now for the heavier portion of our show, joining us is serious reporter, political analyst, and personal friend, Steve Shigaris.
Oh, hi.
So what do you think, Steve? Is democracy in America doomed? Why or why not?
I'm not of the mindset that the democracy project is doomed. I think that I just get the sense that in a period of an extreme partisanship, extreme polarization, voices, the loudest voices being those of the ones who are on the extremes of the political spectrum. It feels like there are significant, it's teetering on the edge. But look, you can point to specific events of recent years and say, okay, this is the beginning of the end. But I think you can also point to those specific events and say, this experiment, this United States of America democracy experiment is a bit stronger than some people are giving it credit for. And I like to sort of be the half glass full guy and look at it through the lens of the latter than the former.
I'm going to read a quote from the Washington Post about Tucker Carlson. Quote, "He has positioned himself as the presentable face of white grievance," said Joseph Azam, who resigned in late 2017 as a senior vice president for News Corp, which, like Fox, was controlled by the Murdoch family, because he objected to the company's tolerance for what he felt were Carlson's hateful views and other commentary. So how do we effectively address the figurative gasoline that is being profusely poured onto the tribal divide in America by far right-wing media outlets like Fox, AON, and Newsmax?
That's a loaded question. Look, this is the United States of America. We've got a First Amendment that allows people to have free speech. Tucker Carlson has a platform, one that is viewed by, 2.5-3 million people every night, in a country of 330 million people. So he has an effect on a very rabid base that agrees with him. Do we think that Tucker Carlson is changing the minds of many Americans? What do we think that a guy who gets 3 million viewers a night is negatively affecting the overall discourse, or is he just speaking to people who agree with him and want to listen to him? Also, you know, the question I have is, what can we do? The guy has a platform. It's protected by the Constitution. You may completely disagree with it. You may think it's way over the top. But at the end of the day, it's protected free speech, and you don't have to watch it if you don't want to. I don't know what else I can say about it other than there's not a heck of a lot you can do except tell your friends and tell your people who might be inclined to watch him and say, look, you know what? I think the guy is X, Y, and Z, and these are my opinions on him. And maybe you shouldn't watch him, and perhaps you can convince people not to do so. But at the end of the day, there's really not much else I don't think you can really do about it.
How far is too far? You can't walk into a theater and claim fire.
Well, you can't walk into a crowded theater and falsely shout fire. So we have to be very specific.
Yeah, there's nothing that Tucker Carlson is doing that's in violation of the First Amendment, nor illegal. And there's no recourse from a legal standpoint unless he libels somebody, and then you take him to court and you deal with it. But I mean, just because you don't like his rhetoric doesn't mean you can, you know, go after the guy and silence him. I mean, again, it's a free speech issue. Again, if you disagree with him that vehemently, you have a First Amendment right to speak out against him. You have a right to try to convince as many people as you can to view him as you do as vile and somebody that deserves to be shouted down. But there's no recourse to what he's doing on Fox News every night.
That's certainly the traditional Democratic small d perspective on how to address those that you disagree with in the public square. But let me just say something, you know, I don't agree with what Tucker Carlson says, but this whole thing that he is suddenly, you know, a new voice for white grievance, he may be the voice du jour for white grievance, but you could go back to Richard Nixon as the candidate for white grievance in 1968. You can start looking at all kinds of radio broadcasters, starting maybe with Rush Limbaugh, who had huge fame, moving forward. And then before Tucker Carlson on Fox, you had Bill O'Reilly, and you've had Sean Hannity, and all of these individuals have given voice to and propagated and even created white grievance.
That's in our lifetime.
That's it. Exactly.
Right. In the 30s and 40s, where it all started, there were many people under the auspices of we are religious broadcasters and we're talking about what is morally incorrect with our society, unquote.
And so I was just about to call in the evangelical crew into that. Yep. Go ahead, Shep.
And the evangelical crew that's born out of what it was that I was talking about. I'm thinking of Billy Sunday. I'm thinking of, what's the other person's name? I can't remember. It's an Alice Cooper. In any case.
Are you thinking of Fulton Sheen? Wasn't Fulton Sheen one of those guys?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes. And he had an amazing following, was able to say a little bit of whatever the heck he wanted to. You know what? In our lifetime, so did Reverend Ike. Reverend Ike was a black radio preacher who eventually made it to TV. And in the midst of the civil rights movement, Reverend Ike vehemently and often said, my favorite color is green. So all that Reverend Ike cared was that he got paid. But putting all that aside, I think that our industry is getting too much credit today for influencing and impacting
I agree.
Society. I mean, the most egregious and annoying things that we collectively have seen over the last 20 years, we've all seen on television. You know, and 20 years ago, this September, 9/11, 2005, we all were shocked at Katrina. And then we have been shocked at the political process as we've seen it. And then just this year, we had an attack on the Capitol, which no one in our lifetime had ever seen before. So we look at the media and people listen to see where to go with it. I want to submit that maybe people who are not comfortable making up their own minds about what it is they see will listen to Billy Sunday or listen to Reverend Ike or listen to Tucker Carlson or listen to
Joy Reid.
Some people may look to other people. I think that, and John Stewart himself said, the greatest disservice that I do is provide people with an opportunity to not pay attention to the news and watch my show, because it's palatable presented in the lens of comedy. And yet people make their opinions based on what I present. Shep, I think that people, yeah.
You were actually in the Capitol that day, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was.
Can you share a little bit about that experience?
I'll make it brief. Once they were going to go to the 2 hours of discussion about who should, you know, what state should be recognized and to participate, I said, great. This is a chance for me to go to the bathroom and get some lunch, because they're going to be here talking about stuff that I can or cannot. I don't need to report on this every hour. I just need to give people the deal. This is still happening, everybody.
Classic Shep.
It is. My priority is in life, man.
When can I go to the bathroom and get lunch?
We're limited on time. Can we
have a brief discussion about something that's more important than what Tucker Carlson happens to be saying on TV every night? And it's what's happening in Republican-dominated state legislatures across the country. It's putting up barriers to access and opportunities for voting. And especially, even though they like to deny it, and they're only undertaking it for one reason, is to make it a lot more difficult for those who are more likely to vote for Democrats to get their votes in and counted. And they're also giving themselves special powers in some cases to say, oh, we don't like the votes that came in from this particular area or this jurisdiction. There must be some fraud there. Let's not count them. Or, you know, let's not ever allow a Democrat who happens to be Secretary of State to participate in the vote tallies and the vote regulations process. So I think that that's the scariest thing. That's a lot more frightening than what Tucker Carlson happens to be saying, because that's literally changing the rules to, as Richard Goldstein was saying, so that, and others have been saying, so that basically you're going to have a permanent minority with the majority power in this country.
I really love this train of thought. We are almost completely out of time. I want to continue this conversation, though.
And that does it for part one of this two-part episode. Join us again next time when we continue the discussion around the insurrection, the future of democracy in America, and Shep will give his full firsthand account of what it was like in the Capitol on January 6th.
Two guys ran in front of me with AR-15s. All the cops you saw on the footage with their guns pointed at that small window in the chamber, they all ran past me, some guns drawn, some not. Nobody said, get the safety. I guess they looked at my credentials and he's okay.